This is the fourth of six lectures on world religions coordinated by the Reverend Michael Schuller of the First Unitarian Universalist Society of Madison, presented at Oakwood Village starting on October 4, 2007. For more information about this series of lectures or about the citywide low-power FM station and its programming, visit citywidelpfm.org.
I think we're about ready to start here this afternoon. Thank you all for coming. I see there's some significant interest in Islam, and hopefully we'll prove to be somewhat illuminating, at least for you this afternoon. If you haven't been here before, I'm Michael Schuller. I'm the Senior Minister of the First Unitarian Society here in Madison, and I've been organizing these presentations for the past, well, this is the fourth of six presentations, and next week we'll be hearing from a gentleman who is a practicing Buddhist. I'll be describing the basics of Buddhism, and then in the last week, a man from the local Hindu community will be telling us about Hinduism. Being a Unitarian Universalist and minister, it goes without saying that I'm not Muslim, and so I'm not speaking from personal experience in this faith tradition. I'm speaking from scholarship and from an acquaintanceship with a large number of... Yes?
I can't hear.
Can't hear. All right, we'll move it up a little bit more. No, we're all out of handouts. Sorry. I don't control the volume level, so I'll try to speak up. Is that better? Okay. So as I was saying, I'm basically speaking not from a personal existential acquaintanceship with the Islamic tradition, but from research both in primary and secondary sources. Having said that, I will also concede that I do not know Arabic. Is anyone in this audience familiar with Arabic? Good. Because then I won't worry about my pronunciation. Having said that, I'd like to open with a reading from the Quran, which is from the first surah. And the Quran is divided not into chapters, not into books, but into surahs, each of which has a name attached to it, and I'll say a little bit more about that later on. The Quran, by the way, is about four-fifths the length of the New Testament. Not the entire Bible, the New and the Old, but about four-fifths the length of the New Testament. And this is simply the very first surah. It's called the opening. Praise be to Allah, Lord of the worlds, the beneficent, the merciful, owner of the day of judgment. Thee alone we worship. Thee alone we ask for help. Show us the straight path, the path of those whom thou hast favored, not the path of those who earn thine anger or those who go astray. That's also regarded as the primary confessional statement of Islam that's repeated on a regular basis by all faithful Muslims. And if you were to ask any Muslim, if they knew by heart any particular part of the Quran, it would be that first surah. Let me just say that the Quran as a whole has often been denigrated by Westerners. If you try to read it in translation, you find that it is very, very different from the biblical literature. It is not really a narrative in the true sense of the word. It can strike us as being repetitious, rather chaotic, and altogether puzzling in the way that it's put together. The Quran was also harshly criticized in the early years after its composition by Christians and Jews, who said essentially that it took many of the traditional biblical stories that you would find in the Old and the New Testament, and it distorted them. It basically misrepresented many of those stories. And if you do read it, you find many familiar figures. You find Jesus, and you find Moses, and you find Abraham, you find some of the prophets, but the way that they're described and the anecdotes that are presented of these figures are ones that you would never find in the Christian or the Jewish Bibles. Unlike the Bible, the Quran represents the revelation of a single man, Muhammad. Muhammad having been chosen by God, by Allah, to be his mouthpiece, and Muhammad was believed to have quite literally channeled God's wisdom and God's desires for humankind. There is nothing about Muhammad in the Quran. In other words, Muhammad is simply a mouthpiece through which God speaks. Muslim apologists will often say that we as Western readers really can't appreciate the nature of the Quran, and that's because when we try to read it in translation the way that we would any other book, we're really misrepresenting it. That the Quran is meant to be read orally, to be presented orally, and it really is a form of elevated poetry. As the Jungian psychologist James Hillman put it, the essence of the Quran is its language, not the truth of its word, so much as the majesty of its song. And when you read, when you hear the passages from the Quran being recited within a mosque, then oftentimes it has a very hypnotic effect if it's being recited in the original Arabic. There is no such thing, by the way, as an authorized translation of the Quran. If you are going to convert to Islam, then it is highly recommended that you learn Arabic so that you can read the Quran in its original language and appreciate its full grandeur and its comprehensive meaning. So when I read from this particular version, this particular translation, and there are many translations, none of them are really considered to be a translation that as a faithful Muslim that you would want to use. You would really want to read it in its original tongue. Islam's root meaning of the word, anybody know it?
Surrender.
It means surrender. And surrender to what? Well, surrender to the will of God. And the word is related, Islam, the word is related to two other terms, salam and shalom, both of which mean peace. Islam is thought to bring the peace of mind, the peace in your heart that comes with full surrender to God. Muhammad is the model for all good Muslim behavior because Muhammad was complete and absolute in his surrender to God's will. He's the model man. Muhammad was a prophet. He was not considered in any sense of the word to be anything more than a human being, but he was the model human being and continues to be the source of inspiration in terms of godly living for all Muslims. Islam right now boasts about 1.5 billion people who subscribe to it, adherents worldwide, about 1.5 billion. It is the second largest of the world's great religions. Christianity would include something over 2 million individuals. The vast majority of Muslims do not live in the Middle East. In fact, only 1/6 of all Muslims are of Arabian or Arab extraction. Where would most of the Muslims live? You see that there's a map on the back of the glossary that I've given you. And it didn't come out terribly well, but just to give you a little bit of an idea of where the preponderance of Muslims live in the world, the Arab League, which includes much of northern Africa and northern equatorial Africa and the Middle East, about 2.84 million. But the most populous Muslim country in the world is Indonesia. And if you go to China, you find that there are over 130 million Muslims in China, 130 in India, 230 in Pakistan and Bangladesh. Turkey, which is not an Arab country, 62 million. Sub-Saharan Africa, 254 million. So 1/6. We typically associate Islam with the Arabic world, but the Arabic Muslims represent actually a small minority of Muslims worldwide. Now, interestingly enough, when we consider that, and we consider the amount of attention that is paid to Muslim fundamentalists, we find that almost all those fundamentalists and the people we might describe as potential terrorists come from the Arab side of the world and a particularly small part of the Arab world, and they represent only a small fraction of a small fraction. And throughout the world, most Muslims live in a way very, very different from the way that they're described in the American media. So, basic tenets of Islam. The five pillars, in other words, the five basic ideas, and they really describe behaviors rather than doctrines per se. And the first is Shahada. And Shahada is simply the confession of faith. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet, the final prophet. May Allah's blessings and peace be upon him. One becomes a Muslim simply by avowing that simple statement that there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. The word Allah, by the way, simply means God. There is no God but God, the God. The second pillar, Salat, which simply means prayer. And the Muslim is enjoined to pray 5 times a day, facing toward Mecca, wherever you are, facing in that direction. And the prayers are performed, if you're familiar with the sun salutation, a particular posture or a particular discipline in Hatha yoga, the prayer is performed very much like a sun salutation. In other words, begins with a stand and a bow, and then a full prostration on the ground, standing, bowing, full prostration. So you can get your exercise by praying in this way. And normally that would be repeated 2 to 4 times, 5 times a day. The content of the prayers oftentimes that accompany the statement of faith, they are prayers of praise, gratitude, supplication. And each one of the prayers begins with the simple phrase, God is great. One does not begin to pray in the mosque or anywhere without ablutions, without ritual washing. The hands, the mouth, the face, and the feet must all be washed preparatory to praying. Men and women in the mosque pray in separate areas in order to preserve modesty, as they say, in order to ensure that men and women are not distracted by each other's sexuality. The Quran admonishes Muslims to be constant in their prayers, constant in order to remind themselves of the need continually to submit one's will to Allah. Because again, Islam represents surrender to the will of God. Reminders throughout the day, those periodic reminders to pray 5 times a day, continues to give us this sense of Allah's sovereignty over our lives. And in the same thing would be true in many Christian monasteries where you have the regular cycle of prayers that are also meant to bring the person, their focus, back to God and to their religious duty on a periodic basis. The third of the great pillars is called Salm, and that means fasting. And one fasts during the month of Ramadan. And this fasting not only involves fasting from food, from sunup to sundown for an entire month for 28 days, but also abstinence from all immoral or idle acts. It is a time of moral discernment and extra effort to connect with God. The month of Ramadan is observed by Muslims worldwide. It's incumbent on all Muslims to observe Ramadan unless your health might dictate that this kind of austerity could damage your health, because there's always the sense that Allah is what? Merciful above all else. And so you are not enjoined to observe all of the rigors of Ramadan if in fact your body cannot handle that. Ramadan commemorates the reason that this particular month-long observance exists. It commemorates two things. The original revelation that was given to Muhammad and the historic Hijra, which was the journey that Muhammad took from Mecca to Medina, which actually represents and marks the beginning of the Muslim era. Ramadan lasts for 28 days, as I said, and during that time, Muslims abstain from food, from drink, from smoking, from sunup to sundown. After sunset, Muslims may engage in activities, particularly eating, not in what we might consider to be the more vice-like activities, but they must do so in moderation. Also, there's restraint from sexual activity through the duration of Ramadan, and there is the reading of the Quran throughout that period, and in the mosque, actually, the entire book of the Quran is recited during the 28-day observance. Ramadan then ends with a major festival called Eid al-Fitr, which is the breaking of the fast. It's 3 days long, and during that time, family members can gather to feast and to exchange presents, and in many Muslim countries, it is a national holiday, those 3 days. It's a time particularly for attending services at the mosque and for paying special alms to the poor, which is another one of the pillars of Islam. The ostensible reason for doing all of this, for doing this fasting, these kind of extremities, as we might say, well, basically, to remind people of their fragility and of their dependence on God, to awaken also compassion. By doing without, then we can begin to identify with people that have far less than we do. The fourth pillar is zakat, which means charity, almsgiving. If Muslims are capable of doing so, they are advised to give 2.5% of their net worth to charity every year, to the poor, basically. If you are poor, then you are not obliged to give that from which your small means, as it were. Wealth is the giving away of one's wealth is thought to purify the giver, purify him or her from greed and from stinginess, and it also serves by virtue of the giving and receiving to reconcile the heart of the receiver and build in them a real sense of gratitude. Earliest Islam, by the way, was not known as Islam. It wasn't known as the religion of surrender. It was called by its adherents and by observers the religion of tazakah, which essentially means generosity, chivalry, refinement. And the Muslim was known primarily by his or her willingness to cloak him or herself in the virtues of generosity and compassion. Karen Armstrong, who has written a great deal on the world religions, says that the basic message of the Quran is not a doctrine per se. It is a thoroughgoing command to practice generosity and compassion. She says, it is wrong to build a personal fortune selfishly at the expense of others. It is good to share your wealth fairly and create a just and decent society where poor and vulnerable people are treated with respect. Now, the reason that this became such a point of emphasis in early Islam is because the world into which Muhammad was born, in which he was raised, was a tribalistic world in Central Arabia. And it had become, by virtue of the success of these various tribes and clans, it had become a very economically successful part of the Middle East. It was highly stratified. There were a few very, very rich clans and a lot of very, very poor people. And it was ruthlessly capitalistic, a lot of competition between the various clans. And in this particular point in time, it was increasingly the case that weaker members of the clans and clans perhaps that didn't have the assets and the advantages were being ignored. Their needs were not being met. And so Muhammad's message was meant to be one that would help to reform what he believed had become a self-satisfied, complacent, and selfish society. The fifth of the pillars is called Hajj, which means pilgrimage. And as you probably have heard, once in a lifetime, usually during the first 10 days of the last month of the Muslim calendar, but it can be done any time, but once in a lifetime, all Muslims hope to be able to make a personal pilgrimage to Mecca. And this pilgrimage is meant to be a reminder of fundamental human equality. And when Muslims, wherever they come from, whatever their status, when they go to Mecca, they remove all emblems of their status. All distinctions of rank and wealth are removed from their person, and everyone alike wears a plain, simple, white, sheet-like garment. If you've ever seen pictures of all the pilgrims streaming into Mecca on pilgrimage, then you will note that they're all wearing essentially the identical garments, no matter whether they are a great clan leader or whether they come from a slum somewhere in Southeast Asia. The experience of going on these pilgrimages is profound for many people. How many people have ever read Malcolm X's autobiography? If you read that, or if you ever see the movie that was made of Malcolm X, you will know the tremendous transformation that took place in him when he went on pilgrimage to Mecca. He had, prior to that time, been extremely hostile to white people in America. He had been very, very parochial in his viewpoints. He had thought of Islam as being a kind of an exclusivistic religion. And he went and saw people from all over the world, including a lot of Caucasians, coming into Mecca, and there was this atmosphere of tremendous, you know, universal acceptance. And he came back from that pilgrimage very much altered in his view of what Islam was all about. And he saw it as being this accepting, compassionate religion. And he hadn't recognized that before. And unfortunately, soon after that, he was assassinated. But one of the reasons perhaps he was assassinated is because the black Muslims in this country saw this transformation, and they couldn't quite accept the new Malcolm X. Some people put a sixth pillar in to the mix, in addition to the ones that I just mentioned, and that pillar is jihad. Are we familiar with that word? Is the first word we're familiar with, so far today? Jihad literally means struggle, effort, exertion. Those are the terms that are usually associated with it. And Muslims make the distinction between the lesser jihad and the greater jihad. Now, the lesser jihad is what we might call the jihad of war or of battle or of physical conflict. Now, according to some authorities, Muslims are actually forbidden to engage in conflict, physical conflict, or in war, except in self-defense. And retaliation, if you are involved in some kind of a physical contest, if you're involved in some kind of a struggle with another entity, retaliation, if you've been attacked, must be strictly proportional to the attack itself. In other words, if someone attacks you and they bruise your arm, you don't necessarily shoot them with a gun. There's always a sense of proportionality in the execution of jihad. If we're talking about warfare, the Quran admonishes Muslim warriors to avoid civilian casualties and also to avoid damaging trees or buildings, the physical property of the areas in which the conflict is taking place. Now, there are others, however, that say that the concept of the lesser jihad, this physical conflict, is not quite so benign, that in fact, Muhammad was himself, from the very beginning of his quest, of his prophecy, was a warrior prophet who advocated the use of force against all of Islam's opponents, anyone who resisted the advance of this particular religion. One tradition has Muhammad on his deathbed urging all of his followers, quote, to fight all men until they say that there is no God but Allah, which gives a kind of an imperialistic twist to his ministry, to his avocation. Nevertheless, this is all about the lesser jihad, and the concept of jihad, if we think of it as being fundamental to Islam, involves much more than this. According to Shah Kazami, the true warrior of Islam smites the neck of his own anger with the sword of forbearance. The false warrior strikes the neck of his enemy with the sword of his own unbridled ego. For the first, the spirit of Islam determines jihad. For the second, bitter anger masquerading as jihad determines Islam. And so the idea is that in the greater jihad, to repeat, the true warrior smites the neck of his own anger with the sword of forbearance. In other words, exercising self-control. So jihad is always struggle, it's always exertion. It can be made manifest in a number of ways. Gaining a sense of self-control, giving generously to charity, concentrating intently on one's prayers, exercising patience, gaining knowledge. All of these things, if they're done in the spirit of honoring and pleasing God, can be spoken of as jihad. And so the greater jihad always refers to the movement against the passionate carnal self. Articles of belief in addition to the pillars. Believe in one alone God. One alone God. Unique, infinite, transcendent, creator and sustainer of all that exists. An unbeliever, an infidel in Islam, is not necessarily defined as a person who denies God, an atheist per se, but a person who is ungrateful, who refuses to acknowledge what he or she might owe to God, who refuses to honor Allah, and maintains a perverse attitude, as one writer put it, a perverse attitude of ingratitude and self-sufficiency. Pious Muslims always begin every action with the words, if God wills, may I be successful, may I acquit myself. And after having completed a particular action, conclude by saying, thanks be to God for my ability to have done what I've done. Secondly, this is the God, Allah, that has been revealed through not just Muhammad, but through a succession of prophets, Jewish, Christian, throughout history. Islam does not claim to be presenting a new revelation, only to be revealing most fully that revelation that was first given to Adam, and then to Noah, and then to Abraham. It's been passed down through Moses and even Jesus. Here, Muhammad claims that the revelation he has received represents a return to a previous revelation, an uncorrupted revelation that came to the early individuals to inhabit our world, Adam, Eve, Noah, and most particularly Abraham. It's a return to what he believed was pure Abrahamic religion. Abraham is extremely significant in Islam. Particularly, it's a figure perhaps most revered in the Quran. First, he's revered because Abraham, as we perhaps remember, married a woman named Hagar, and Abraham and Hagar produced a son by the name of Ishmael. And Ishmael is the putative father of the Arab peoples, in the same way that Isaac is regarded as the forebear of all the Semitic peoples. So the idea of Abraham and Hagar's relationship producing Ishmael is extremely important to Muslims. And Abraham is also very, very important, more important for Muslims than certainly Moses or Jesus or any of the other great biblical people would be, because of that episode where we remember him sacrificing at God's command his own son Isaac, which for Muslims is an example of absolute, pure, unstinting faith in God. There is a holiday in Islam called Eid ul-Adha, which is a 2 to 3 day holiday, which comes after Ramadan, which commemorates the sacrifice, or the almost sacrifice of Isaac by his father Abraham. Muhammad himself is believed to be the culmination of the prophets. They call him the seal of the prophets. And basically, he held that there is no inherent contradiction between what he is revealing to the world and what all previous prophets have revealed. There can be no division, there can be no contradiction between what the great revealed prophets have given to humankind. All those teachings somehow must be reconcilable. And so there is always the sense that these great figures venerated by the people of the book, Jesus and Isaiah, that all of these were true revelations. The Muslim might complain, however, that these revelations have either been corrupted or needed to be corrected by the final revelation of Muhammad. Let me just say a word about the Quran itself, which is a third article of faith or article of belief. It is the Quran, the only standing miracle in Islam. The word Quran literally means recitation or reading, and it is considered to be utterly sacred. The Quran is thought to be true in all of its particulars. It was thought to have been transmitted verbatim to the chosen individual, Muhammad, a man who did not even know how to read and write. And that's why it's considered to be the standing miracle of the Muslim religion. The Quran represents, as one writer put it, God-made word. It's the same way that in Christianity, Jesus is considered to be God-made flesh. The fourth belief, core belief, is in eternal life, in a corporeal state of being. In other words, we will have, a faithful Muslim will have eternal life in a physical form. Muslims believe, as do many Christians, in the end of the world, in a final judgment day, in the resurrection, and they believe that it is possible for an individual to spend an eternity either in heaven or in hell. Human beings are thought to possess free will and therefore have the decision to make decisions that can land them either in heaven or in hell. There is also a belief in angels. In Islam, angels are believed to be creatures of Allah. They are agents of Allah. They are always faithful. They are always obedient. And in fact, it's not God per se that delivers the revelation of Muhammad. It is actually the angel Gabriel. There is also a belief in the decree and plan of God. Everything that happens, for good or ill, happens because God, the one God, has decreed it. And nothing can possibly fail or alter God's plans. This basically means that this is an extremely strict monotheism. There really isn't any room in it for a devil who can subvert God's plans or is the agent of evil, the producer of evil. Whatever we perceive as being good or evil is all the result of God's intention and God's plan. This, of course, brings up a tension in Islam because Islam believes that human beings have free will, and on the other hand, God has a plan for everything. And so there's a continual tension between the individual's freedom and the kind of the predestinarian assumption that's made about God. And then finally, human beings act the way they do, not always in a generous, compassionate, and righteous manner, not because they were fallen from some original state of grace, as the book of Genesis might suggest, but because human beings are, almost by nature, forgetful. There's no need for human beings to be redeemed from some original sin by a supernatural Savior. What needs to happen through the Quran and other sacred writings is that people need to be simply reminded of who they are, who God is, and what the proper relationship should be between human beings and God. Basic premises of Islam. How's my time going? Let me just tell you a little bit about the beginnings and early development. How many people are actually familiar with the story of Muhammad and his evolution? A couple of people? Okay, well, most people are, so I'm going to kind of skip over this fairly quickly and then just talk a little bit about the sacred texts. I already described pre-Islamic Arabia. It was a situation in which, as I say, there was a great deal of economic competition. There were developing hierarchies between rich and poor. There was a lot of what Muhammad would have described as being corruption in that particular society. And there was a lot of blood feuding that went on between these powerful clans in that particular part of the world. The religious climate in pre-Islamic Arabia was a mix of polytheistic Arabs, basically what he would have called idol worshippers, but also a significant number of Christians and Jews. The polytheists believed in what they called the jinn, and the jinn were these beings, malevolent or sometimes good spirit beings that inhabited the desert. And Allah, spelled A-L-L-A-H, was one of the jinn in the old Arabian religion, was one of the gods in the Arab pantheon, but was considered by most Arabs to be first among equals, not the only god, but perhaps the most powerful and influential of the gods. Loyalty in this particular society was based not on your religious beliefs. It was not believed based on any kind of sense of nationhood or ethnicity. It was based entirely on blood relationships, which clan you happened to belong to. And one of the worst fates that could befall anybody was to be ostracized from your clan or to somehow repudiate your clan and your blood relationships. Most of the people who married, well, virtually all the people that married, ended up marrying cousins or some close relatives so as to maintain that clan solidarity. Muhammad himself was born into a respected but not perhaps the most successful of clans in Mecca, and he belonged to a clan that was called the Hashemites. And some of you might be aware of the fact that the Jordanian dynasty traces its lineage all the way back to Muhammad and to the Hashemite clan. He was born in 570 AD. And according to legend, he had been faithful to Allah, to the one true God, since childhood. He had not, like many of his peers, fallen into idolatry. And because his parents both died when he was fairly young, he went first to live with his grandfather. When his grandfather died, then he spent the rest of his childhood with an uncle who treated him very well. He married at the age of 25 a rich widow by the name of Khadija, and she was 15 years older than him when they married. She was already quite wealthy, having been herself a successful businesswoman, a trader that managed caravans going through Arabia and into India and points farther east. She is born in several children, including a woman by the name of Fatima, who ended up marrying one of Muhammad's cousins by the name of Ali. He left no male heirs, Muhammad, when he died. He only left female descendants. Muhammad became his wife's right-hand man in business, and together they prospered in their trading enterprises. When he was 40, 15 years after his marriage, he was in the vicinity of Mount Hira, outside of Mecca, where he was accustomed to go for solitude and to pray to Allah, when suddenly he was literally embraced, as he describes it, by this angel Gabriel, to the point that he could hardly breathe. So tight was this embrace. And he asked, what do you want from me? And the command came, to recite. And the first words of the surah came spilling out of his mouth, almost as if they were squeezed, you know, right out of his inner self. He was having a very hard time believing that this wasn't the action, the influence of some evil jinn out in the desert. So he went home and he told his wife about this, and his wife was the one that corroborated, no, I think that this was really Allah speaking to you, and I think it's legitimate, and she became his first convert. This, by the way, are the first words that he received. Read, in the name of thy Lord who created man from a clot. Read, and thy Lord is the most bounteous, who teacheth by the pen, teacheth man that which he knew not. That was the first revelation, which, by the way, is found at the very, very end of the Quran. So if you're thinking that this somehow is a chronology, you know, from beginning to end, it's not chronological whatsoever. These revelations continued for 13 years. And during that time, as he was receiving these revelations, Muhammad was also trying to establish, you know, his credibility as a prophet, as a religious leader. And in doing this, he tried to enlist the support of the Christians and the Jews, who were also monotheists, and therefore he thought kindred spirits. And in the beginning, he actually tried to cultivate the Christians and the Jews by incorporating a number of different practices into his own nascent religion. For instance, fasting during Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, praying not toward Mecca originally, but toward Jerusalem, raising the number of mandated prayers from what had been 2 in his early estimation to 3 and then to 5, and then adopting also many of the dietary restrictions that were typical of Judaism. All of these were borrowed artifacts that he incorporated in an attempt to win the support of the Jewish and Christian communities. Muhammad insisted in his religion on a complete change in the way of life and the culture of Mecca. He wanted to destroy all the idols that were the physical idols that could be found at the Holy of Holies, this place called the Kaaba in Mecca. His opponents, the polytheists, were very, very angered by these attempts to purify Arabian religion, and they threatened to kill him, which was the reason that he had to leave Mecca to go to what is now known as Medina. At that time, it was a city called Yathrib. And in 622, he snuck out of Mecca under threat of his life, and moved to Medina, which is actually a word that means the city of the prophet. Among those who turned against him ultimately were not only the polytheists, but also the Jews, because they, in reading some of the revelations that he was producing, said, you know, the characters sound familiar, but the stories are not the stories that we know from the Tanakh, from the Old Testament, and therefore this guy is perpetrating some new kind of heresy. He's inventing all this stuff out of whole cloth. So ultimately, the Jewish population also turned against him, and he was more or less on his own. Eventually, Muhammad was able, because he was an extraordinarily resourceful man, to win the support, largely because of political promises he made, not necessarily because of his religion, to win the support of many of the most powerful clans in Arabia. And by the end of his life, he had been the first person who ever succeeded in uniting all the clans in the Arabian Peninsula, essentially under one jurisdiction. Let's see here. I might just mention that he also is reputed to have built the first mosque, the first official place of worship for Muslims. And that mosque in Medina became the model for all subsequent mosques, for their arrangement, for their architecture. And so a typical mosque will have a prayer room. There will be a niche in one wall which indicates the direction to Mecca. There will be a place for the speaker to stand and to declaim, to deliver a sermon or a teaching of some sort. And there will be a place for ablutions, for the washings that have to precede the prayers. And that particular model continues to be the model for all mosques. Sacred texts. Say a few words about the sacred literature. The Quran is divided into surahs that I've mentioned before. And they go from longer to shorter. So the longest surahs are at the beginning, and as you move through the Quran, they become shorter and shorter. There are essentially two groupings. There are the surahs that were composed or that were given at Mecca before the move to Medina, and then there were the revelations he received once the migration had taken place and he was living in Medina. The surahs in the Meccan period have to do with kind of history. They describe the things that happened to Abraham and to Moses and to all the great biblical characters. And the ones that were composed at Medina have much more to do with legal obligations and the norms that needed to be set for Muslims to live in community. The titles, every one of the surahs has a title, but it doesn't give you any indication by the title what actually the contents of that surah is. Titles usually just refer to a particular word or a particular image that is included in that particular surah. But again, it does not give you any sense of what you're going to find in that particular surah. The assumption, as I said, in Islam is that the Quran is true in all of its particulars. It is absolutely without error of any kind. It didn't reach this final form during the time of Muhammad's life. Actually, it was not until the reign of the third caliph, a man by the name of Uthman, who lived from 644 to 656, that the Quran took its final form. Because what we really had originally were all of these revelations that had come piecemeal over this long period of time, and they were just kind of a jumble. Okay? There was no necessary rhyme or reason. They didn't come in any particular sequence that would make sense. And so they were heard by Muhammad. They were supposedly memorized by him. Then they were transcribed by someone, and then they were collected. But it was not until fairly long after his death that this collection of disparate materials were brought together in this final form. And so you don't have a system whereby the Bible, for instance, was composed over a 1,000-year period. Here you have all of this material being given like in an explosion in a short period of time, and it was left to later people to kind of bring it all together in some kind of form. There is nothing in the Quran about Muhammad himself. If you want to find out about Muhammad's life or about, you know, his personal doings, there's nothing in there whatsoever. He is simply a conduit for God's word. And so if you want to find out who Muhammad was and what you might want to do to model your life after this perfect man, you have to go to other sources. And the other sources are called the Hadith. And there are 6 volumes of the Hadith that describe in minute detail Muhammad's life and how the truths of the Quran played out in his life. And so you see him embodying and exemplifying the teachings of the Quran through the Hadith. And so the two have to be taken together in order to understand, you know, how to comport yourself as a Muslim. There are also 2 kinds of Hadith. There are the Hadith that come from the observers of Muhammad's life himself, and they describe Muhammad as a man and as a practitioner of Islam. And there are Hadith that refer to some of the earliest followers, kind of the saints of Islam, and they're considered to be also exemplars and people that you might want to emulate. And then there's a whole other set of Hadith that are only used by the Shiite Muslims that have to do with the life and the teachings of the great Imams. And so it depends on whether you're a Sunni Muslim or a Shiite Muslim, which Hadith and how comprehensive the Hadith will be that you use. I'm going to finish up with just a word about Sharia. Familiar with the word Sharia? Okay, Sharia derives from an Arabic term that means road, and it basically means the road to God. And the Sharia is the comprehensive law that governs relationships between Muslims, and basically is a legal code, a very sophisticated legal code. And the Sharia is based on the Quran, it's based on the Hadith, and it is also based on a couple of other practices within Islamic jurisprudence known as qiyas, which is logical or analogical reasoning. Scholars, imams, since the time that the Quran and the Hadith were composed, look at those materials, they look at contemporary circumstances, they look at the issues that are arising, and they use their own judgment or analogical reasoning to decide, you know, how these things might apply today and to establish precedents that can then be incorporated into the overall Sharia. Then there's another part of the Sharia that is created by what they call jma, which is the consensus of the community. It's something, some practice is adopted by certain authorities, and then it becomes widespread in the community. After a time, it begins to be treated like common law. In other words, this usage gives it a certain authority that allows it to be incorporated into the Sharia. And the Sharia basically is that comprehensive totalistic system of laws that sanctifies all of life, as Muslims would put it. It's meant to be applied to all of life. And in this respect, Sharia is kind of similar to what in Judaism is called mitzvot. And the idea, particularly in conservative Judaism, that if you consult mitzvot, the law that really kind of defines proper Jewish behavior, then you'll find everything you need in it in order to be a good Jew. And similarly with Sharia, it provides everything you need in order to fulfill the requirements of Islam. There are only actually about 70 actual rules of behavior in the Quran. In the Bible, in the Old Testament, there are 613 rules of behavior. So they're not very many. And so the Hadith fills out and amplifies what you find in the Quran. And usually, if we're talking about, well, is something recommended for a Muslim to do? Is something prohibited for a Muslim to do? You really can't go to the Quran. You have to go to the Hadith or to this analogical reasoning that a succession of scholars and imams have produced over the centuries. Last word, simply about Shia and Sunni. The Shiites, who we're very familiar with now because Iran is predominantly a Shiite nation, and Iraq is predominantly a Shiite nation, and Lebanon predominantly a Shiite nation. Shiites represent 1/5 worldwide of all Muslims. That particular sect or division in Islam originates with the 4th caliph, Ali, who was, as I mentioned, also Muhammad's cousin. And the Shiites believe that they can trace a line of succession from Ali through 8 other imams, and that their own tradition comes then directly from the Prophet through Ali through the succession of 12 imams total, and that therefore they are actually the true heirs of Muhammad's teaching. There's a kind of an apostolic succession here. And all of the imams now in the Shiite world believe that they are actually also true successors and are a part of that lineage that goes all the way back to Ali and to Muhammad. And the Sunnis don't believe that. And the Sunnis have no tradition of imams, these authorities that claim to have this particular lineage. And so that is one of the sources of disagreement between them. Now, the other thing that's really important here is, of course, Shiites, the great imams and people like Ali and his son Hussein, another great imam, their weight in their estimation in Muslim eyes is almost as great as that Muhammad himself. And so there are special holidays that the Shiites celebrate that are essentially commemorations of these great imams. And there are special shrines that Shiite Muslims make pilgrimages to. And those pilgrimages are almost as important to them as the pilgrimages that Sunni Muslims will make to Mecca. And one of the reasons that Iraq is such an important part of the world for Shiite Muslims is that many of those shrines actually exist in Iraq. And Shiite Muslims from all over the Middle East want to have access to those. And of course, the worst thing that could happen is for one of those to be destroyed, which the Sunni Muslims have a habit of doing. And this obviously exacerbates the tensions between them. And I think that that's probably enough, because I've been talking for 50 minutes. There's a lot there, so let me just see if in the last 10 or 15 minutes you have any questions. The Kurds.
You
know, my basic, I can't give you a complete answer on that, because my basic presumption is that they're Sunni. There are a lot of Kurds that are secularists, actually. Most of the Shiites in Iraq are in the southern part of Iraq, and because Turkey and that whole area is Sunni, is almost exclusively Sunni, I'm going to presume that the Kurds are Sunni Muslims. But that, you know, if someone knows better than that, they can correct me. It's just an educated guess.
Can you give some indication of what Muhammad thought the status of women and how that has evolved since then?
What Muhammad thought about the status of women and how that has evolved since then? Well, Muhammad lived in a misogynistic society in which the status of women was nil. His wife was somewhat of an exception in being, you know, a businesswoman of some stature. And he claimed to be bringing a greater measure of gender equality to that part of the world by virtue of his teachings. He recommended, as famously, that men could have as many as 4 wives, which was not necessarily unusual at that particular point in time. Arab clans were known for having harems. But his stipulation he put on that was that no man could have any more than 1 wife unless he could give her her due, do justice to her, love all of them equally. And so he basically made it incumbent upon the man, if he was going to have more than 1 wife, to be able to do justice to her and to treat her, you know, as a, if not as an equal, with great humaneness and compassion. And that would have been an improvement at that point in time. Muslim world is all over the map in terms of relations with women, and many of the things that people ascribe to Islam as being disrespectful to women or demeaning of women are actually tribal customs, or they are customs that come out of the local milieu, and they're not necessary, and oftentimes they're often abhorrent to Islam per se. So the idea of that a man can indulge in an honor killing and kill his wife if she's been unfaithful, that's not Islamic, that's tribalistic. Certain other conventions, like the separation of the sexes, well, you know, that's also true in conservative Quaker communities. It's true among the Amish. It's true in conservative Jewish synagogues, the separation of the sexes, and the wearing of the veil. There are Christian and Jewish and Muslim communities in which the veil is considered to be an important article of dress for women. So it all depends on which Islamic community you're talking about and what the prevailing norms are, you know, culturally. They are. The calls to prayer, if you're in an Islamic community, you know, you would be called to prayer by the muezzin from the minaret, the top of the minaret, and it would be a prescribed time. But typically, Muslims would know at what intervals they're supposed to do their prayers. Well, actually, I think in this country, they don't last very long, by the way. They don't last very long. And in this country, you cannot, of course, discriminate on the basis of people's religious practices. So if you're Muslim and it's incumbent upon you to do your prayers, then typically that has to be permitted. But we're not talking about a large, long period outside of the workplace. Again, you do 2 to 4 of those prostrations, you know, with sincerity of heart and complete, you know, attention. That fulfills the letter of the law. And so it shouldn't get really in the way of people's performance at their jobs. It might even help.
I think
it depends on the culture. One of the things that Nasser tried to do in Egypt and that Ataturk tried to do in Turkey was to separate the religious from the secular. They were great fans of secular education in the West and tried to develop a secularized educational system. In most Muslim countries, there is not that rigid separation, and so the inclusion of Quranic studies is going to be, you know, normative in those cultures. The basic principle would be in Sharia that you cannot possibly have a completely secular education and still remain a good Muslim. You know, that it has to include this religious dimension. Education, like everything else, falls under this totalistic concept of what it means to be a Muslim. Now, there is a difference, however, between incorporating Quranic studies into a curriculum and the madrasas, which are these fundamentalist academies that sprung up in Pakistan and Afghanistan, in which virtually all secular learning is excluded. And the only thing people are taught is this very narrow and rigid kind of Islamic fundamentalism. And that's not representative of Islam overall.
And trying to reconcile the attitude or the policy of murder between the Sunnis and the Shiites, is there anything in the Quran? It's my understanding that it is
What would be provoking?
Murder.
Oh, murder? There are Quranic references to retribution, to criminal behavior and what is permissible. Murder is obviously prohibited. But the idea, it's not opposed to the idea of capital punishment. It's not opposed to the idea of killing in that regard. Yeah.
Well, my own seems very similar. I'm not sure I didn't fight with you. Seal something and cut off your hand and that sort of thing. Is that actually part of the law?
There are citations, there are provisions within Quranic and Hadithic literature that call for that kind of eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth form of justice. And generally what is held is that in Islamic jurisprudence, it is the atypical society, and Saudi Arabia is one of those atypical societies, where the letter of the law is imposed. That in most societies, there are options. And because of the precedents that I mentioned before, and because of the comparing of what the Hadith has to say and what the Quran has to say, and kind of adjusting and reconciling those, most often that kind of penalty is not imposed. That's the general rule in most Muslim countries. But it is an option, and in a strictly fundamentalist country like Saudi Arabia, it is often imposed.
The first page, just below halfway down, it says, a protected subject,
right,
one who belonging to a religion tolerated by the Quran. This includes Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians, Hindus, Buddhists, and Sikhs.
Mm-hmm.
Evidently, Muslims and Sikhs are very accepting and all-inclusive.
It depends on the period of history that you're talking about. There is a citation, actually three of them in the Quran, in which it's emphasized that there can be no compulsion in religion, that Islam does not actively seek converts, and that if a person wants to maintain their Christian or their Jewish identity, they must be permitted to do so. Interestingly enough, in the great conquests that followed the death of Muhammad, in which northern Africa was conquered and much of Syria and Iraq, many of the troops that were fighting on behalf of Islam or the Arab clans, the United Arab clans, were Christians. They weren't just Muslims. The precedent was that if the Islamic armies would conquer a particular place, everyone was permitted to retain their original religion, but they had to pay a tax in order to receive that benefit, to maintain that right. The ostensible reason for that tax on Christians and Jews and others was that it was incumbent on Muslims to give 2.5% of their income, as part of their almsgiving, their charitable obligation. Well, that's not incumbent on Christians and Jews. And therefore, in an effort to kind of equalize the two segments of these territories, they imposed a tax on those people that were not Islamic. That's at least one way of interpreting it. Some of the Muslim emperors were incredibly tolerant. The Mughal emperors who built the Taj Mahal and ruled Pakistan and India and at large swath of that part of the world were incredibly tolerant, and the tolerance of Buddhists and Muslims in particular was representative of the Mughal emperors. But there are places, of course, where there's very little tolerance, and again, it depends on kind of on local custom, not necessarily on Islamic teaching.
So don't have the son that has nothing in the Quran which says it's your duty to kill the infidel. Is that completely?
It's mixed. It's a mixed bag. It's a mixed bag. There is a sense in the Quran of the tolerance of the people of the book, the people who share that prophetic heritage, Christians, Jews, Muslims. But there is a very strong condemnation of polytheism and of those that, will not honor the monotheistic principle, which Christians, Jews, and Muslims do. Which, of course, makes Hinduism a little suspect, because Hinduism is not a monotheistic religion, but we'll just, leave that aside for now. So there's very strong language condemning the infidel as being the polytheist. Now the interesting thing for our own world is that some of the very conservative fundamentalist Muslims have taken these condemnations and these justifications of aggressive war against the polytheists, the infidels. That was part of Muhammad's original context when he wrote, when he composed all these things. And they have transferred that sentiment to the modern age, in which fundamentalists like Osama bin Laden essentially say that the secularized West resembles in many, many ways the people that Muhammad was fighting against, and that they pose a very real threat to pure Islam as we understand it. And so when Muhammad is talking about the infidels, we can easily make the claim that contemporary secular West is just as bad, just as corrupt, and that's part of the justification for the kinds of anti-Western sentiment that we see.
Michael, could you speak a moment about revenge and how they, you know, these days it is dealt with?
In Islam? The basic teaching of Muhammad is that one, again, if there is a reason for you to seek revenge, it needs to be proportionate to the injury you've received. It should not be disproportionate. But the other part of it is that if you've been offended in some way, the first thing you should try to do is to exercise forbearance, okay? And to control your own reactivity and your own emotions. Now, how that plays out, today in terms of our politics and the larger world, it depends on who you're talking to. I mean, because Muslims, like Christians, are all over the map on these issues. And there's no uniform answer you can give. But if you're talking about the Quran and the Hadith, typically the first recommendation is to exercise forbearance rather than to immediately strike out again. Any other questions? Well, thank you. You've been an outstanding audience. I appreciate it.
Cool.